don't know if you know what this is, but those little figures at the bottom are people. And this was the set for Intolerance, which was literally outside the walls of this building in 1916. It took over the whole streets of Sunset and Hollywood and Hillhurst. And for years thereafter, for decades, parts of it hung around. It became a public eyesore and actually pretty dangerous, but it was much beloved. This was actually D.W. Griffith's second hoped to be blockbuster after Birth of a Nation, but he got so much pushback for Birth of a Nation because it featured the Ku Klux Klan that he decided he would create this mammoth, colossal spectacle, four stories. And in fact, that's how big it was. Look at the people. No expense was spared. There were four segments, each tinted differing colors, and it actually made his company and his producers go broke. Birth of a Nation had been the shot heard around the world. This film basically was the shot that he heard when he was no longer employable. So anyway, when the Hollywood and Highland Center was created, they did an homage to that set. That's why it looks the way it does with the elephants and that fantastic gate. It's from Intolerance, which was a part of the Hollywood landscape, as I said, for decades. And yea, verily, Vista, where we are now, has always remained. And it's always had an impact on the community. It can still have lines around the block. We love it. And in fact, famous films have been shot here. And just around the corner, Intolerance was 1916, was none other than Walt Disney and Ub Iwerks. They were best friends. They came from the Midwest together in 1922. Walt had already suffered through, a bankruptcy. He'd come to this exciting place called Kingswell Avenue around the corner. Now I got two different street addresses, so I'm just telling you that's what it looks like. And together they set up a business. Now their actual storefront was over by the Dresden Room. And so this producer from Universal, Mr. Winkler, came over and he saw their drawings for the Alice pictures. And he said, could you draw me a little film called Oswald the Lucky Rabbit? And this was just right up Walt's alley. And Ub did all the artwork and said, absolutely. And so they took this, finished this little short film, 1927. And in those days, and Walt was the visionary. And Ub was the actual drawer, but they were a partnership. And so in those days, you had to take the train. And so the name of this fantastic train was called the 20th Century. And Walt, left from Pasadena and went across country and had to change trains in Chicago and get to New York City. It took 3 days. And he got there with this wonderful little animated film, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And then they showed it, they premiered it in New York City. It was a sensation. Now, it was a silent movie, but nonetheless, 1927 was a seminal year in film history. And then suddenly the producer turned to Walt and said, well, thank you very much, but you're fired. And Walt was devastated because he had all these bills to pay. And he was facing bankruptcy. And so he got on the train very dejected, heartbroken, and halfway across America, he said, you know what? That rabbit, what does it look like, folks? It could be a mouse. And so he said, from now on, Ub and I are going to own the property. We're never working for anyone again. And that was the beginning of Walt Disney Pictures. And then a few months later, guess what happened? Of course, Steamboat Willie. And in that little barn, the garage behind the Kingswell Avenue place was where Walt and Ub and his wife Lillian and Ub's wife, they did the music and the sound for this little film. It's actually the very first sound film, Sunk Up. And that's the beginning of history. So here we are, film history as we know it today. And here we are in the Egyptian. And I'd like to pay homage to the season we're in, which is Epiphany. I love this particular photograph of the three wise men. They're only mentioned for a few verses in the book of Matthew, no other gospel. And yet, we know there were several wise men. We don't know how many. The lore is there were three. And we know that they had extraordinary knowledge of the stars back in that era. And astronomy and the records of the patterns of the skies have proven that on a specific date, 2,000 years ago, there was a great star rising. And it was apparently an alignment of Jupiter and Venus that was extraordinarily rare. And they think maybe many wise men met, but certainly the story is that three found their way to a manger. We have, because of this story, the word epiphany. Epiphany is central in storytelling because what we are doing is creating wonder when we tell a story. You and I, when we tell a story to each other, we're going, wow, did you hear? Now, that's the source of gossip. It's also why we're into the 24/7 news cycle. We want to open our minds. We open our hearts. We crack through our egos and our ignorance, and we understand a whole new world. Of course, storytelling can also be vicious and spread lies and be poison. That's how potent it is. But what we've discovered in storytelling, the thing that's most potent, is when a story shows and reveals transformation. So what I want to get into now is a bit about my history, where I come from, the great state of Kentucky, where there's some great storytellers from there. Abraham Lincoln, of course, D.W. Griffith, the father of modern cinema, and Muhammad Ali. Where that little town that I grew up in, Kentucky's very remote, it's hard to get around, the geography is dense, so that if someone came to visit you, you put out a piece of pie and gave them a cup of coffee, and everyone sat down. You just dropped what you were doing and you told a story. Consequently, it was the iPod or the CNN of the day. That's where you got your news, and I'm telling you, I sat at the feet of world-class storytellers, and I thought this was the way life was. Why would I think any differently? And the stories would turn on a dime from comedy to tragedy to pathos. It was an extraordinary, rich experience. What I learned from my family is stories of our past that went back 200 years because my family were Revolutionary War grant farmers. So that meant my forebears fought in the Revolutionary War. They were immigrants. My family told the stories of those who came over from Germany and England and basically the British Isles. It turns out to be a very important thing neuroscientists have found in the at Emory University, that if you parents want your children to have a stable sense of themselves, you should tell the stories of your own family's past. Because you should say, you know, grandma and grandpa or great-grandpa and grandma went through the Depression and they went through these wars and your mother and I, your father and I had these setbacks. This provides a sort of context by which your children can envision the future they're in and know that they will have the resources to not only survive, but thrive. So getting back to the world we're in, of course, there was the Industrial Revolution. We all know that. And in the middle of that came some atrocities like child labor. And it was Charles Dickens who decided to tell the story of his childhood through a semi-autobiographical novel, David Copperfield, which he serialized, which is to say that he sent it out in chapters. And this is the thing about storytelling. He opened people's eyes and hearts and minds to a world they would never have otherwise seen if it weren't for storytelling, and he changed labor laws. It was a seminal event in child labor history, David Copperfield. Now, around this time, of course, it was an extraordinarily inventive era. Thomas Edison discovered, through the help of Edward Muybridge, cinematography. This is hand-tinted images. Now, Thomas Edison's great talent was that he was a businessman. And so he decided with Eastman Kodak to create the standard of 11-minute films. That's all you need, you know, because he'd created the light bulb and the phonograph. He didn't see any reason to go beyond 11 minutes. And guess what? You don't need a star, don't need a director. All you need is Edison's name. It's good to be king. So in 1903, this was the blockbuster hit of its day. We're not going to watch all 11 minutes, but the Warner Brothers sold the Family Mule just to get a copy of this. This is hand tenant. Went across the United States, would throw up a sheet on a barn, charge everybody a nickel, which by today's money would be $6.50. And this is what they would get at the end, this giant image of a man colorized, pointing the gun at him, and oh my God, they were electrified. It was the paranormal activity of its day. On this river of pennies and nickels, the Warner Brothers came to Hollywood, and they created, of course, Warner Brothers. Now, D.W. Griffith, meanwhile, was working away. He was a part of Edison's monopoly. Now, Edison had decided that only 7 companies should be allowed to make movies, which is to say each one had 1 week to make a 1-reel film. So that is to say, if this were going on today, that Friday's Paramount could broadcast their film, and Saturday's Universal could broadcast theirs, and you know maybe we'd give Sundays to Fox. That's how Edison thought about it. But it turned out that every Thursday, audiences were lined up around the block for Biograph films. And Edison couldn't understand this. Why? You know, he was putting out widgets, units, like light bulbs. Why would the audience betray him like this? Well, it turned out that D.W. Griffith was doing little stories with people like Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Charlie Chaplin. And by word of mouth, the audience was saying, wait till Thursday, it's the Biograph film that's worth your time. And that was the beginning of Hollywood and the power of the audience, word of mouth, and most importantly, the power of story. Now, Charlie Chaplin said that D.W. Griffith is really the father of us all. And he was reading Charles Dickens, you know, who was, you know, the J.J. Abrams of his day. And believe it or not, people had riots on the New York Harbor docks because they're waiting for the next chapter of Little Dorrit. And all the artifices of what we know as cinematography today had been around for 25 years. That is the long shot, the tracking shot, the medium shot. But no one understood what cinema could really be until D.W. Griffith, when he was reading Dickens, realized, hey, you can cut into action. And that is editing. And when he proposed this to the producers, they were like, no, audiences will not accept that. You can't show a woman worried, wringing her hands at home, and then cut to her husband on an abandoned island in the middle of the sea and his shipwreck, and then cut back to the woman who's wringing her hands. And he's thinking, why not? The audience is smart enough. They can put together that she's worried about her husband. Keep in mind, part of my story is the producers and the executives always resist you. They say it can't be done. And so then he said, you know what? I think we should have a full evening of story, not 11 minutes. Let's do it like opera. Producers said, we can't do that. Opera has music. And D.W. Griffith said, good idea. Let's have an orchestra. And they said, well, how much would that cost? And he thought, and he said, well, maybe $1 million. And then they fainted. That would be about $100 million today. And so he did Birth of a Nation, which was an homage, yes, to the Ku Klux Klan, but it was the shot heard around the world. Everyone suddenly got what cinema could be. Sergei Eisenstein in Russia, all the Europeans, everyone got it. Now, everyone came to Hollywood. What a great place where we live, right? And why did they come here? Just a little bit more history. Well, Edison had goons, literally with brass knuckles, who would break up anybody trying to make a film. They saw them shooting on the street. He declared that he owned all the patents, but specifically the patent of the sprockets, spinning the wheel of the camera and projector. So people started fleeing across country to California, where there was sunshine, a world of eternal sunshine. And William Fox and Carl Limley decided to sue Edison, a suit that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court under the Sherman Antitrust Act, and they won, and Edison was stripped of all his patents. This also happened when Europe was at war and Russia was at war, so by the luck of all these experiences, Hollywood began to dominate. But the other thing that caused Hollywood to dominate was, in fact, these storytellers, these particular group of interesting men who created Hollywood, believed in the common man and our dreams. And so what they've actually created is what we're in now in the 21st century is the age of story. Why do I say it's the age of story and no longer the industrial age? Because now apparently our gross national product around the world, but specifically in the G20 nations, is driven by story or intellectual property, which also includes software and video games and entertainment of all kinds. We're hearing around us 24/7. What's your story? What's the story of this product? What's the story behind, you know, ISIS? What's all the, everything's about the context. How do we identify the world we're in? You know, it was Norman Lear, one of the greatest TV producers of all time, who said, we live in an emotionally, the most emotionally cluttered era in history. And so what we're seeking to understand is the story. And what does a story do? A story allows you to align your insights, your heart, with your emotions so that you can get a context and clarity on the world you're in. So the future is going to be how well you tell your story. Now, I want to talk about, you know, if D.W. Griffith got Birth of a Nation out in 1915, then actually the 75th year anniversary of the, you know, historians will say that 1939, that's 75 years ago according to 2014, was the greatest year yet in cinema history. Look at all these classic films that happen. We have Stagecoach, we have all these great stars, we have John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Judy Garland, but of course the greatest film of them all, Gone with the Wind, which by today's box office dollars would still be number one if you adjusted it for inflation. It would have won all the Oscars except for one little film that came along. How many of you have seen this? Did it already come? Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Well, Robert Donat, that was the story of a school, house, of the headmaster of a British public school, you know, think Eton. And it's a story of a man who's always dealing with training the minds of seven-year-olds who come into this posh boarding school. And as they grow up and they leave and go to the Cambridge or Oxford when they're 17, but he's always growing older, as he's always dealing with young men at the age of seven. Now, these young men will go on throughout the 50, 60 years that he's a headmaster to become prime ministers, generals in armies, captains of industry, and he will have shaped their minds. But he is always dealing with the same age level. Well, that's kind of how I feel about my life, because I'm always dealing with the same age level at USC, 20-somethings, 30-somethings. I've also done a study of Hollywood history, and I will tell you that we are the youngest art form in storytelling in the world. If you think about it, music's maybe 100,000 years old. Poetry, we don't know, 50,000 years old. I don't know, who knows how old the Book of Job is, right? Drama, we do know, is 5,000 years old. Then Gutenberg invents the printing press in the 13th century, and that creates literacy. And it creates nation states, it creates newspapers, and it creates literature. So literature really, as we know, it's say from Balzac on to Dickens to today, is only 350 years old. So Birth of a Nation was in 1915, when we finally understood editing, long-form storytelling, and close-ups. And if we had the greatest era 75 years ago, what are we, you know, what's going on in our lives? Why are we here? And in fact, it's been said just last week that the 2014 box office was the worst in 20 years. So it's all going to hell in a handbasket. And today we get the Academy Awards. And we know there were no breakout films that were slam dunks this year. And in fact, the New York Times said that if you combined the box office of all eight films, it wouldn't even come close to the box office of one film, Gravity. So the audience is staying away by millions. Is this the worst thing in the world? Well, I will tell you that this is great news, because it's like every 25 years, the storytelling form has to hit its worst moment in order for this whole injection of new talent to come in and reinvent the form.